Support for Designed By comes from generous donations from listeners like you. Visit AIdesigncorps.org/donate.
And so I tested it on about 150, 200 people and, you know, had 15 formulations, got it down to the final three, got it down to one. And 6 months later, I had Dr. Mark Hyman on my board. I had Ann Veneman on my board, both huge supporters. She used to run the USDA and the UNICEF World Food Program and sits on the board of Nestle. He's the 800-pound gorilla in the world of functional medicine. And this was exactly the alignment that I had hoped for. And then I had a product in market and we were selling. And I was like, oh, I think I accidentally started a company.
Scanning all frequencies.
Hello. Welcome back to Designed By. I'm your host, Joanna Pena Bickley. Today, we're diving deep with a guest whose life is a blueprint for making waves. I couldn't be more excited to introduce you to Raina Kumra-Gardner. As a CEO and founder who is reshaping how we think about food with Spicewell and a trailblazer in digital transformation who spent time at Juggernaut, she's redefining leadership. With roots in Ayurveda, Raina's path from design tech to functional food innovator is nothing short of inspiring. Imagine having a hand in everything from advocating for ethical tech with Ethical OS to steering tech strategy for the US global media to transforming the digital landscape of iconic brands. That's Raina for you, advisor to Google X, speaker on ethical AI, and a voice that challenges the norm. You see, the more that I've gotten to know about Raina, I have realized that her story isn't just about an impressive resume or career spanning tech, media, and investing. It's actually deeply personal. After navigating a family health crisis, Raina turned to the healing power of food, channeling generations of knowledge into Spicewell. And you know what? She's aiming to enrich our diets with nutrient-packed essentials. Raina's vision? A world where the food we eat is our medicine. And she's starting with the basics. Salt and pepper reimagined. She's not just changing how we season our food. She's sparking a movement for healthy living one meal at a time. So I want you to turn up your smart speaker and get ready for a conversation that will challenge how you see design, leadership, and the power of intentional choices. Raina Kumra-Gardner is here today to share her adventures and innovations and how she's designing a better future for everyone, everywhere, every single day. Listen, I know that every one of my sheroes has an origin story. Where does yours begin?
I would say I'm going to go all the way back to childhood. And I was just that kid who wanted to try everything. I went to all the dance classes and I never really stuck with any to my parents' frustrations, but I just wanted to try everything and then decide what I was going to do. And over time, I think that morphed into me just enjoying doing a variety of things. And I've always fallen in love with huge problems ever since I can remember. And my first attempt at providing a solution to those problems was going to film school and becoming a documentary filmmaker. That was how I was going to address issues. I saw the power of documentary storytelling, images, music, all of that. And I saw how it could change my mind and I saw how it could change other people's minds. And I knew there was a lot of problems that we had to enlighten people on and inform people and educate. And, you know, I could have gone into journalism, but I just knew that documentaries were more effective, at least from the way I saw it. So that was the origin story. And that was sort of the first step in the ladder for me of becoming who I am and really finding my purpose and my dharma and starting to design a life around not what was offered to me and what was in front of me and what, you know, typical careers could have been, but what I really wanted and had no choice but to do.
You know, I have always found that it is so true with innovators. Number one, we're addicted to problem solving. That's kind of, it's an addiction, right? But one of the things you talked about kind of in your early part of it was the idea of trialing things and getting a sense of like taking it in. And I've always found that in problem solving, that's actually I feel a part, the messy part of exploration, maybe not just for yourself, but and figuring out, you know, I think we always think about that we only have like one story or one narrative in our careers. In fact, when I know in my own, you know, so had I looked back and said, would I be in big tech where I started out? And the answer was absolutely not. I would never have imagined that for myself. But it's always been a method of when the door opened and you saw the problem, and then you went, oh, that's an interesting problem. I want to learn more. That I always found that attraction. How about you? Tell me a little bit about the kinds of problems that you were attracted to in your early days, particularly in the, you know, in trying to tell the stories of the people trying to solve those problems.
Yeah, I think it's okay. So initially, it was more about wanting to understand how to change people's minds. So that sort of documentary filmmaking career led into me falling in love with tech, which was another thing that was sort of lapping at our cognitive facilities and you know, shifting our behavior and changing our lives. And I also studied anthropology, and I was just really fascinated with how these outside things were going to shift our perspective, change us as humans. And obviously, I think we are all changed since the dawn of technology, for sure. And so that led me into a career in advertising. And that's how I really began my, I think, practical work that was also creative, that was also just bathed in design. Design was so critical to every message that went out. And I found my people. I found people who understood business, who loved making things happen, who loved shifting people, giving them a moment of beauty, giving them something to think about, and they also really knew how to package things in a gorgeous way. And I learned so much. And you know, 15 years, the kind of end of my career in advertising, I was running Wieden & Kennedy's Digital in New York. I had like, you know, the biggest blue chip clients. And then I had a pro bono client, which was One.org. And that was sort of my gateway drug into social change and impact work. And that's how that sort of signaled this sort of third part of my career.
Tell me a little bit about what that impact was. And it's interesting because once you get an itch for public service, it doesn't go away, does it?
No, it doesn't. I found it just a completely different feeling. Like I didn't feel like I was working at all. Versus, you know, running this campaign for Nike or doing this pitch for Coke or the, you know, running this campaign for Facebook. It was all at the time work. And some of it was interesting, some of it was sort of meaningful, but nothing was what really working on solving poverty, like 1% of poverty by giving 1% of capital to solve poverty and to see the impact that they had. So it was our pro bono client, which we used to joke and say it was our pro bono client since he was the head of the board at the time. And I just fell in love with everything around how they approached the problem. They saw it. They were like, this is what we're going to do. And then they did it at such a huge, successful scale. And I think that's what I saw. I was like, oh, all of these skills of selling stuff is really transferable to changing the world. So let's just drop all this sneaker stuff and soda stuff and let's go change the world. So I'll say I took the social impact in working with Africa from One.org so far that I, you know, I left my career in advertising and I started a nonprofit in Malawi. Now we had some connections in Malawi. My mom grew up there, and I thought, okay, you know what? Like, there's a huge problem here with poverty, and there is a solution because it's actually a very sunny country, does very well with solar energy, but There's another problem in that every time a solar panel needs to go up, or a solar farm needs to be put together, they fly in consultants from California or Europe or wherever, and they install it and maintain it. And it's like, a solar panel is a circuit. Like, I know I can wire that. I am sure I can teach others how to install and maintain solar panels.
Right.
And as green energy was really growing at the time, and especially in Malawi, this is an income stream for them. So I started this nonprofit called Light Up Malawi. We got a whole bunch of courses, we got a whole curriculum, and we were training villagers on installing, maintaining, and repairing solar panels, so that they could take these fees versus outsourcing it out of the country. And they learned a lot, and we ended up getting acquired by a larger nonprofit, and then I took a job at the State Department. And so, like you were saying before, you have that itch and it doesn't go away. So that was sort of the next platform. And I don't think of it as, okay, it is a chapter, but it was really me taking my skills from advertising to impact, which was platform one, then taking it to government, which was platform two, which is sort of a combination of impact and
Yeah.
policy and regulatory stuff. But it was just so exciting at the time to be there. I was under Secretary Clinton in the Obama administration, and I had a blast. I had a blast just being someone who was so different, and in terms of
Yeah.
employees and a totally different skill set that I could share, that I could help enhance and really take things from 0 to 100 instead of just, 90 to 100.
Tell me about the work that you did at the State Department. I think that's such an interesting chapter in a world where we don't have enough diplomats, right? And you were stepping into a time, I think, kind of at a historic time, not just because we had Secretary Clinton. Let me start with, complete fangirl and probably one of our best Secretary of State outside Madeleine Albright, in my opinion.
Oh,
But
yeah. Oh, she was
right,
amazing.
but. I think we were also stepping on the world stage at a time where I don't know that our diplomacy was what we were known for. We were fighting two wars. What was that like coming into from like the world of a non-government organization to something that was so complex at a time when maybe there was a yearning and a real cry for diplomacy from America?
I mean, it was my first foray in any sort of political government job, and I actually found a lot of the higher level stuff really distracting from what I knew I could do just working kind of on the ground. So we would stand up these tech camps to teach, and go from embassy to embassy all over the world to teach grassroots organizations how to use open source technology in a better, more efficient way. And so that helped them become more effective in their work, which was obviously beneficial to the interests of the embassy and, the interests of democracy around the world. And that was awesome. But I also found that there was, everything is hierarchical in the government. And, if you want to be a policy strategic, person having those conversations, it's a different pathway entirely. And it's also a very closed circle. And I just sort of, I saw that and I was like, I don't need to be in that clique. I'm actually very happy doing my thing and really providing a benefit that only I can provide. There's very few folks with digital skill sets in this office, right? So I started with that, and then that work grew, and it was, I did well, and then I was asked by President Obama and Walter Isaacson to go and run, co-run the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which is the largest international media organization in the world that you've never heard of, because it's only for international audience facing, so Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, and then I kind of got to marry, my old world of media and digital with a dusty old radio agency that needed to be dragged into the 21st century, and it was a lot of work. Thankfully, I had a wonderful partner. I think one of the best working relationships that I was paired with, a former public radio executive, and we worked together. His name's Rob Bull, and he's incredible. And we did a lot. We sort of blocked and tackled, and they were so smart to give us kind of share the job versus putting just one of us in there, because they knew if it was just one of us, we'd be out of there. So yeah. Together we were able to really handle a lot of the transformation work. And I love doing, you know, it was one of my first really big transformation projects that I'd run soup to nuts. And it was great to see the impacts of, like, okay, so now we have a whole new brand, we have 72 new mobile websites, we have partnerships with iTunes, we have partnerships with SoundCloud, you know, we have all these things, we have content partnerships with Vice magazine, like all these surprising things that you would never think. And we've improved the content, we've improved the mission as much as we can. And then I was done. And then I was like, okay, I gotta leave DC. It's time for the next thing.
So tell me a little bit about the process of transforming something so vital to, you know, so vital. I always look at radio. First of all, I have always loved radio. And I think it's one of those, I think it's an unsung hero. It's also still in so many uses, the way that a lot of people gather in information, particularly when in a very mobile society, you know, if you think about the vast majority of Americans today, and I understand this also Europeans, this applies to both Europeans as well, is that we spend a lot of time in our cars.
Oh.
So the idea of, you know,
no one more than LA.
Okay, right. So the idea of being in the car and listening to the radio and gathering information and finding that, but bringing it into the 21st century amidst a time when, you know, we're at the kind of the dawn of podcasting, right? The dawn of everybody grabbing a mic, mm-hmm. You know, a real transformation in the internet. And then the emergence of, you know, technologies like AI and smart speakers. Tell us a little bit about the process that you took to take something that, you know, is 100-year-old technology, right, organization within the government, and transform it in what it became.
Okay, well, the first lesson of transformation is that nobody wants it. It's always sort of, you know, the board decides, and then it kind of trickles down to some leadership, and then, you know, all of a sudden transformation is happening to you instead of with you. And so I learned a lot from that first go around, especially with lifers in government. You know, they have worked through all these administrations. They've seen people come and go with their new ideas, and, you know, they don't care. They're just like, I'm here to do my job, and I don't need to take on your transformation. So it was a real uphill battle. But the way we designed it is that we really embedded a lot of incentives. And so the incentives would come sort of from the press coverage or the public glow that they would get. Or, you know, we formed a board of really, really magnificent, you know, leaders in tech, like Ev Williams, founder of Twitter and Medium and now a new thing, and Chris Hughes from Facebook. We had Walter Isaacson was the chair of that advisory board, and we had, I mean, just incredible journalists and big names, very recognizable. And it was exciting for a good percentage of the employees that, you know, we were trying to help shift and say, okay, this sort of transformation, a digital advisory board, is going to help us set our strategy for the next 5 years. Do you want to be a part of these conversations? And if they said yes, it's like, okay, well then, you know, we need to do this, this, and this for this office to get it ready. And that's sort of how we were able to kind of turn the psychology a little bit, because I initially started making websites. I had an agency for a long time. So, you know, we'd make websites. So, and also at Wyden, right? We would deliver these incredible, nice, slick websites, but the vision that was in there didn't match with the organization. So what ended up happening more and more in my career was that I'd present the vision and they're like, oh, we actually need to get like that. So I'd end up doing more organizational design in my work, and more more therapy and psychology than you would think.
It's totally, because as much as we know that we need to change, and as much as that we say that we want change, change is hard.
Yeah, so hard.
Change is hard. I find it both on a personal and organizational level, because I think, you know, we often strive to, and this is so true, I think, in the industrial era, that everything becomes about the routines that make things efficient, as opposed to the routines that make things resilient. Efficiency and resiliency often are at odds with each other.
They are. That's so true. I like that. Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is. It's not what you would think. Anyways.
Gotcha.
It
was a lot of work, but it sounds like it was incredibly rewarding.
It was so rewarding. I had the best time. I was so lucky. You know, I was still single at that time. So, it was very easy for me to pack a bag and leave for 2 weeks and, you know, come back for 4 days and then go to a different country. And, you know, I enjoyed that work so much. And I enjoyed bringing people together on a shared mission. I enjoyed lighting fires and helping them burn in the right directions. You've done all of this in your career. I know you have. I know you don't just sit there and do a rote job ever.
Ever. No, you know, it's a part of the, it's interesting that you talk about it, because it isn't just about, for me, it's never about finding the vision as much as finding the purpose. The purpose and the vision are one and the same often for me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know that in having led large organizations, both large and small, whether it's a 5-person organization or a 1400 person organization, right? That you have to build belief.
That's right. That's right.
And I think one of the things that that President Obama was remarkable at was building in belief for a better tomorrow. And I can see where you could very easily dedicate your soul, right? Time would mean nothing to me if you thought that you, if you truly believed that you were going to impact somebody's life in a better way, you know, or make it better than the way that you found it.
Yes. Yes. That really resonates big time. I mean, you can't just take the job as it's written.
I don't think, you know what, no. I always find it's like, if this is my favorite thing to do. And when I interview with people all the time, it's like, I'll sit and it's like, who wrote this? Because if you're looking for this leader, I ain't your gal. This isn't
I know.
Me.
I know. Well, they don't know what they're looking for a lot
That's
of
right.
the time.
That's right. They just know
the
they're looking for a
of the layers, you know, the onion, basically, of, okay, well, this is the organizational design, right? This is, and this design is preventing this, or it's allowing this to happen. And then you put peel back, and then all the way down to the core, which onions don't really have a core, but organizations do, and it's all emotions. It's all,
well, it's a lot of tears when you peel an onion.
Yeah, it's a lot of tears. It's so true. It was a very apt metaphor. But you know, at the end of the day, like you said, it's the belief and the hope, and it's their why. And for me, if I'm doing work that is not aligned with my why, it's draining. It's straining, it's hard, but it's so gratifying when you have even a little bit of alignment, like, you know, a good overlap will be enough to kind of fire up that battery and keep it running all night versus what, you know, and then you find people who are like in these careers and they have worked their tails off for a life, I think, that they didn't really want. And then it's like, just get out. You can just see, it's like, this isn't what you want to be doing. Like, I can see you're miserable. You should totally just leave and be a baseball coach if that's what you want to do, you know?
Exactly. Hey, listeners, super exciting news. I'm going to let you in on a top secret innovation that Vibes AI has been working on. Vibes AI has just dropped new audio vibrational therapies. If you're looking to enhance your memory, relaxation, focus, or overall cognitive wellness,
this one's for you. Vibes AI has been working with certified sound and music therapists to design vibrational audio therapies that are designed to connect your body, mind, and intention. You can choose vibrational therapies that reduce anxiety, encourage deep focus, enhance concentration, and improve cognitive function, bringing you back to a healthy alignment. Don't miss out on this incredible cognitive wellness innovation. I want you to open up your favorite podcasting platform and search for Vibes AI, or simply ask Alexa, open Vibes Therapy to follow the Vibes AI frequency.
Welcome back.
I think it's so hard, though, because I think we have these rote ideas of what both life is supposed to be or what a career is supposed to look like. And I have always found is that, you know, look, for me, design has always been a learning journey. Mm-hmm. And if I thought that I could get something out of it, meaning not just a paycheck, because that for me is like design isn't a career for me. It's a calling. And the calling is about a calling to learn more.
Yes.
I try to walk into rooms where I know nothing about the problem. And then it's my job to study up really fast and become the fastest student of that problem space, and then go experience the problem with people. Because I always find as a designer, if you don't have a cultural attachment, if you don't have a real foundation or empathy, you can't fire the team up behind mm-hmm. articulating why we're here at 3 a.m. trying to solve really hard problems, or why you need to be on a plane, you know, in the middle of the evening to go save the world. And as noble as it sounds, sometimes you've got to, I've always found that great leaders like yourself very rarely just define it for themselves. They're trying to light a fire under people. And if you look behind you, there's a legion of people following you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's 100%. And I'll add to that. And, you know, you can't really begin to solve a problem without an insight, and you can't get the insight without talking to everybody and interviewing and living with them and understanding what's in their closet and what's in their fridge and what are they listening to, and, you know, really fully, like, 100% overlapping empathy on everything that they experience. And that has also been like a lifelong ideal for me. It's just, you have to be able to put yourself in other people's shoes, but it's a superpower because it allows you to take that perspective and do everything with it.
Yeah, it absolutely is a superpower. So you go from government. So talk to me about, like, what's the transition? Because at some point in government, transitions happen. I know we had a remarkable transition in 16 that I don't think any of us knew what was going to happen, but here we were. Yeah. Where'd you go after being with the State Department and then leading this transformation?
So we had a really great run, and as you know, like I said before, people don't love transformation. There was still a lot of resistance in the building, and there was still not even that, but, you know, I'd say some level of toxicity, which happens in old and new organizations. And I think just for my own health, mental health and, you know, my physical health, I would walk into the building after, you know, some time, and I would feel like the hairs on the back of my neck stand up, and I was like, oh, this isn't good. So, you know, I had been thinking about making a move. I'd kind of come in and done what I promised to do. The president, you know, patted me on the back and said I did a good job. And that was literally all I was like, okay, that's what I came here for.
That's exactly right.
I came here for a pat on the back by President Obama, and now I feel like I could leave. You know, this was was the penultimate thing for me. And then I moved back to New York, and I had an agency that I had let be dormant during my time in government. Yeah. And I kind of fired it back up and did a few more projects with Meta and with, you know, Burberry and Neiman Marcus. And I loved it, but it was just work. It wasn't like alignment. It was intellectually interesting, but maybe not spiritually aligned. And I did a few impact clients as well, and then moved back to California in 2012. And I actually followed one of my investments in as the CMO because I fell in love with the problem that they were solving, which is why I invested. But they were called Maven, and they were looking at the prepaid customers all around the world and how expensive mobile credits are. And Maven essentially allowed any user to use an app, interact with an app, download an app, and get win mobile data credit. So you could essentially create or patch together a fully sponsored mobile data plan for yourself and your family. And we had really fast growth. We raised 7.5 million in venture. We had 5 million users. We were on a great trajectory. We were about to bring an enterprise product to the US. Google wanted to acquire us. And then we had an investor step in and just blow up the deal.
Oof.
And we did so in a way that basically led to us having to shut down, because we said no to some capital that was coming in because we thought we were getting acquired.
Yeah.
Anyway, lessons you cannot learn in business school, you can only learn in I won't even say in business, I will say in Silicon Valley
Yeah.
specifically. And the same investor was really pressing on us when I found this little data leak we had. So we had mostly Android users on our platform, and there was a flaw in the system where we were able to see app level data, which, that's what they gave us permissions to
That's
see what they
right.
were doing on our app. But we could actually see all of their app data. We could see
Oh,
everything
okay.
they were doing. We could see everything they were doing all day long with their phone, whether they were on dating apps, whether they were, who they were messaging at 2 a.m. And I was really concerned about this. And I went to our board along with the CEO, who agreed with me that, we should shut this down and we should repair it, or at least let Android know that they have this major
Yeah.
flaw, security flaw. And the investors were like, "No, you need to monetize this. This gives you an
Wow.
advantage. Like, now you know which apps are using. So now you can, get ahead of your competitors." And I was like, "Oh my goodness." And then so we shut down, and then I joined Omidyar Network, sort of the other side of the table, as an investor. So I was running a portfolio on technology ethics because I had just sort of come
You
from
had
this
just come out
experience.
of this, like,
I was like, there's no ethics in Silicon Valley. Like,
no.
it's not as if not on anyone's mind. There literally isn't even a word.
Well, what's interesting to me, and this is the part about the short-term gains. Listen, I think that we've always known that data was the new oil, right? And it's been that way for a while. I think more so now because, AI is the great refinery to the oil. I've always looked at it from that perspective. What was always interesting to me, listen, I was on the East Coast at IBM. And I always felt like when we would bring up ethics on the West Coast, there was this weird, like, just tension as if it was, counter to capitalism, as
Yeah,
opposed to, right?
exactly.
As opposed
Exactly.
to thinking about what has effectively happened. If you look kind of fast forward to now, right, where people have realized that their data that they've been giving up is so incredibly valuable. And when you have a data breach, you stand to lose dollars and trust. Trust equals dollars in the long run. In a world where we subsidize half the technologies today through subscription-based models, the keep and churn in the, to keep you from churning on those models, a data breach is the first way to lose your customer. And so it's a really interesting thing that I think you bring up, and that when it comes to AI ethics, it isn't counter. If you get it right, it is not counter to capitalism. What is counter to capitalism is not being on the upfront with your customers and saying, this is exactly how we're making, like, I am creating this convenience and the value exchange you're getting out of this convenience is this, and this is how we're monetizing it with some transparency and giving them the option to go, this is the right business model or it's not.
Exactly. And then I think as part of that work with Amit Aaron, you know, I wrote a few checks and then I also developed this framework called the Ethical OS. And it really, really talked about some of that. Like, you know, why are we not letting users know what they're signing up for? What is this deal with the devil that we're clicking on a box? We should be aware. There should be transparency. And more than just transparency, like, they need to understand what the long-term effects are, because the user is just being treated like a user instead of a person.
That's right. Well, and it's the reason I don't use the word user. It's people always said, oh, that's such a silly notion. I said, no, users, you know what? Users in our vocabulary become addicted to things. If you have a really good product, they use it because they love it. Not because they love it so much they are addicted to it and can't put it down. Like that there's a healthy relationship between the brand, there's a healthy relationship between the tech and the that end customer, you know, who inevitably, I tend to find that the vast majority of applications today still don't do yet enough on the explainability of when you use this, it's, you know, you are the service. Like, your eyeballs are truly the service.
Exactly. And there's just, yeah, there's so much that, so I would bring up the word ethics in Silicon Valley, right? Mm. And people immediately feel judged. So we had to change it to unintended consequences as the phrasing, you know, it's like, how do we avoid unintended consequences versus saying, hey, let's talk about ethics, because nobody wanted to talk about ethics.
But yet you were out there and you were talking about it. And I think it was actually one of the, I think so much of the conversation that still needs to continue today, but being a pioneer in that space, what was some of the good and the bad that, that you faced in being an early voice to the ethics space?
Oh, I mean, I think we learned a lot. So the good is that there was a lot of work to be done. And foundationally, I think the framework that we put together really hit on enough things. So I call it the wheel of misfortune, and there's these eight risk areas, and you want to look at any product around eight dimensions, you know, user transparency, and you want to look at unintended consequences around criminal activity. You want to, you know, so how could something be abused, or how could it be misused for another's gain, or how could it be dangerous to, you know, someone on the fringe, and really taking into account the users, the people who are not in the room in Silicon Valley, who are the ones who I think, you know, get the worst of it. And I'll send you an image of the Ethical OS so you can see in the wheel of misfortune. But it's the eight dimensions, like, still hold up. And so what I really, like, I guess the bad of what I encountered is that people were like, I don't, like, ethics. Yeah, sure. Let's hire somebody at Stanford to talk to us about ethics. And I was like, you don't need an expert. Like, this is very concerning. You shouldn't need an expert for ethics. Like, I think we can do this, people. And then to your sort of, you know, what you've done in your career, I really looked at, okay, here's the problem.
Yeah.
People don't want to talk about ethics. They don't think they can. They feel like they need to be an authority. How do we make it easier, simpler, faster for them to adopt some principles that will benefit society in the long run, especially since they're the makers of the technology. They're the creators. And I had, you know, we had a 72-page research paper with lots of things, and it was great, but it's like, we cannot drop a thud factor on anyone. That's not going to get read. And so, like, what is the way to solve the problem by 1%? And that is a one page, 1 to 3 page document that can, and it's a PDF and we'll make it free and it can live everywhere. It can be all, it's open source. And with that, I think we made a big impact. I think we made a really big impact. In fact, I see it in ChatGPT's policy updates sometimes. I see some of the same phrasing and the same language. I see the thoughtfulness of founders today as they're talking about AI technology, and they've taken, I know they've seen, you know, the 8 risk
areas. When they're, my favorite thing is to watch somebody else on stage and they're cribbing your stuff without giving you credit. But the reality is team and listeners, do yourself a favor, go seek this out. It's at, is it at Ethical OS?
No, I'll send you the
okay.
link.
Great. And we'll post it in the show notes for sure.
Yes.
Because I think it's so relevant to right now with all the training that we are doing with women and upskilling them to utilize artificial intelligence, to utilize data, right? When we talk about AI, it's about using data. You can't use AI without using data. And so, you know, part of that training is having that ethical framework so that you can question your own organizations to begin answering these questions. Because I think that you're right. Do we teach ethics? And we should. Absolutely. We should be teaching it at like the elementary school levels. But for some reason, it gets lost in translation.
Yeah. I mean, we really all, I'd say every engineering school in the US for a long time, computer science, missed the boat on making that a requirement. It should have always been. But it's not too late. And you can still,
it's
you can
never
still
too
change
late.
The norms. And it's been really gratifying. Like, you know, I love people cribbing it because I'm like, I did that. I don't get credit for it most of the time, but that's okay. I know that it was the 1%. It was a ripple effect. And that's so fun to see.
Right. Well, I think it's important as a part of the why we do this podcast is that you do get credit for it. Because I think one of the things that is so important, if we want to see more ethics, and I actually kind of believe that women bring something unique to the ethical conversation. And it's funny how we are tend to be the canary in the coal mine on these things. When we do not assign credit, then we are the hidden figures of this generation.
That's
and what
true.
That has had has been a chilling effect on more women trying to learn or fearing something. But I think if they realize that it was created by women or that it was even influenced by women, the creation of some of these technologies, I think it would be helpful. You know, I believe that you cannot be what you cannot see.
Yeah.
The second part of it then says, is what is being put in front of me, taking a point of view that may apply to my culture or where my point of view is an empathetic human being. And it's not to say that men aren't empathetic, but I think one of women's superpowers is that we have an intuition that it's always an overdrive. I think it's hormonal, to be honest with you.
It could, yeah. I mean,
at a hormonal level.
I think that makes a lot of sense, actually. And it's not just the empathy. I think it's, we're just more responsible. We're just responsible for a lot more. So we see.
We don't have a choice.
Yeah.
We don't have a choice. We as women do not have a choice in not being more responsible.
No, we don't. What's the alternative? I think, you know, like, the female climate activists and the male climate activists, the female climate activists are so much sharper, I feel like, and so much more effective. And whether they have children or not, they are doing this in a way that is driven by care, by actual care. And that's kind of, you know, what I felt like for the Ethical OS. And, you know, if people aren't thinking about disinformation and they aren't thinking about addiction and they aren't thinking about economic inequality and hateful actors and surveillance and, you know, even just the basic thing, you know, implicit trust and does a user understand stuff. They're not thinking about any of those. We're already doing everything wrong. So let's just do the baseline.
Right.
Let's just do a one page document that will give you the full semester of an ethics course for
Absolutely.
your tech career.
Absolutely. And I think this plus some regulation will help.
Oh, big time. And it's happening. It's,
Yeah.
I stepped a little bit away from the ethics AI consulting work, but I'm engaged here and there on it, and once in a while I get to really dive back in. But in the past, like, we launched this 8 years ago, and it has really, like, it's so different now. Everything's different. The
Yeah.
there weren't even departments available in government to work on some of this, and it's so nice to see from afar. And part of me wants to jump back in and be like, "Yeah, let's go, let's carry the flag all the way and plant it." But I'm also like,
You
"Okay,
planted,
no,
you're
my
a
work
great leader.
done.
You planted the seeds. You
That's
planted
it.
the
That's
seeds.
what I do. That's what I do."
Yeah. So we go from the ethical OS. You're very involved in climate. And then I really want to dive into what has, it seems like, at least from my perspective, has hit just a zeitgeist moment, is going from the importance of environment that is so tied to what we eat and our food. Tell me a little bit about the journey between, going from ethics in the world that we're living in to now this journey where you find yourself on. What feels like, as somebody who's watching you and cheering you on, and like a super fangirl of your product and you, but love the product every time I get a chance to use it at an event, we are utilizing Spicewell. But let's talk a little bit about how you go from that to today.
Well, first of all, thank you. You have been such an incredible supporter, and it's like amazing. It's amazing. It's always women. It's always the women who are the most helpful, the biggest boosters. And I could not have known that I would ever in my life get so much help, because I have always been the helper. And then I was like, oh my God, I'm in a new industry and a brand new brand, and so many, I'd say, just angels have come around me and like made this happen alongside me. So, and I really think of you as that too. So I just want to make sure you hear that. And
Listeners, I am blushing. If you can't hear it,
yeah,
like I'm like
she is
slightly,
blessed.
it's like
She's
I'm
totally
very
blessed.
much.
Okay, so I had moved to LA 6 years ago, kind of left Omid Air Network and was consulting. And I had started a fund, an early stage fund called the Fund LA, that was pre-seed capital. And so I was like, carrying on in my investing career, thinking this is the path. I could do this. I love helping entrepreneurs. And then it was the pandemic. So during the pandemic, my husband had a knee surgery that was long overdue. So we, booked it in and did it. It's a good time because no
Yeah.
one's going anywhere. And brought him home from the hospital. That was all, ready to play nurse and help him with everything because he was immobile. And then about 7 hours later, my 5-year-old daughter broke her collarbone in a bike accident. And
Oh my gosh.
So we had like 13 EMTs in the house. It was crazy. It was just like chaos. So then I'm back to the hospital with her, and then it came back, the dust settled, and I have one upstairs who cannot move, cannot get out of bed, and one downstairs who cannot move, get out of bed. So I was just
And
running
let's not forget, this is all happening in a cataclysmic
around.
moment in human history.
Yeah, where you really can't just, call for help, because this was the time when we were all very crazy and wiping down Amazon boxes and not letting anyone in the house. And gosh, I look back on that time and I have so many emotions, but I just dropped everything I was doing. And because of the pandemic, which was actually the gift of the pandemic, I was able to fully focus on just one thing, which was getting them back to health. And I made every meal. I did all of these herbal tinctures and these drinks and Ayurveda. I talked to my mom and I got some recipes from her, and I used my grandma's recipes of, like, different things you can do for joints and different things you can do for inflammation and swelling and bruising. And all of it pretty much involves turmeric, by the way, and
Which is
a number
it
of
is a
other.
miracle. It's a miracle.
It is. And I just, my husband's a gardener. He's a very avid gardener. We had a ton of broccoli and kale growing in the garden. I just sort of chopped that down and dehydrated it and crumbled it into their smoothies and on top of their food. And because they're, both of them won't eat vegetables. So like a 5-year-old and a 40 something year old. Well, I was like, okay, I still have to hide the veggies for the adult too. And I knew from when I broke my elbow many years ago in another bike accident, I did a lot of Chinese medicine and Ayurveda to heal it. And it healed very fast. I was out of my cast in 2 weeks. And my daughter had the same experience. And my husband did too, in that using the right nutrition and herbal remedies and botanicals and using the exact right combination and making sure that you get real vitamins from real plants, from real foods, vegetables, actual vegetables, not vitamin vegetables, right? I got them back on their feet in like 2-3 weeks. And the doctors were so surprised. They, you know, thought it was going to be like a 6-week turnaround for my husband before he could really start walking around. My daughter was super, I mean, kids do heal fast, but in 2 weeks, she was running around again, which could have been a lot longer. And I do attribute it to their nutrition. And then I got really fascinated with, okay, how does a vegetable work in our cell? Like, how does this benefit exactly? I took a certificate course at Cornell in plant medicine. I really understood that the things that the plant does to keep, defend itself are the exact things that we need to heal ourselves.
Yeah.
So like all of those compounds and phytonutrients and I just had the best learning time. So again, I was learning something new. I fell in love, but I hadn't yet found the problem. So then I was just, I kind of found a solution before the problem. And then I found the problem. And the problem was 94% of Americans have a nutrient deficiency. Further to that problem, 3.7 trillion people or $3.7 trillion are spent on people trying to remedy themselves, chronic illness, the healthcare system. It's not even a billion, it's a trillion. It's more than our defense budget.
Yeah.
And it's all avoidable. It's all manageable if we just ate the right amount of nutrients. Because being malnourished or, you know, having a nutrient deficiency is going to turn on some of those chronic illness genes, right? So they'll stay off if you do the right things, you exercise and you eat, but they will start to switch on if you're constantly depleted. And because American food is so highly processed and because our soil is really, really poor in minerals and nutrients, like broccoli grown in the soil 25 years ago had way more magnesium content than it has now. Even if you eat the organic, you know, farmer's market version, it's still not enough. Our soil isn't sustaining us, and it all starts with the soil. So I was like, okay, what's the 1%? What's the 1% solution on this huge problem? What can I do to help everybody do just a little bit better and get more access to a variety of vegetables and get more access to minerals that are better absorbed in your system? And a lot of people don't know that you take a gummy vitamin, you're really only absorbing 20% of what's stated on the label. If you take vegetables or vitamins from an organic source, you will absorb 80%. So I just sort of looked down at my salt and pepper one day. I was like, this is the perfect thing to conceal flavors of vegetables. Let's try it. And I gave it to a bunch of friends. You know, Liz Heller being one of them. I was like, this is what we're working on. And
this is the season, just so my listeners know, the season of Liz Heller. I guess at this point, I'm going to have Liz, who, by the way, is one of my board members, one of my very best friends. Listeners, this is the third interview I've had that we've had the Liz connection. So Liz is the godmother of connectivity some days.
All good things flow through.
Yes,
this.
That's right.
He's just one of those very magical people. and she loves wellness. And
yes, she does.
Yes. And so I tested it on about 150, 200 people. And, you know, I had 15 formulations, got it down to the final three, got it down to one. And 6 months later, I had Dr. Mark Hyman on my board. I had Ann Veneman on my board, both huge supporters. She used to run the USDA and the World UNICEF World Food Program and sits on the board of Nestle. He's the 800-pound gorilla in the world of functional medicine. And this was exactly the alignment that I had hoped for. And then I had a product in market and we were selling. And I was like, oh, I think I accidentally started a company.
I accidentally started this remarkable company. What are some of the misconceptions you felt like? Because to your point, I think it's like you have started many companies, but now you're the brand, right? Now you've gone from being the consultant on the brand to actually having ownership and building of the brand. And I think one of the things that I love about Spicewell in the brand is that it, at its core essence, is a healthy lifestyle system, right? That frankly is truly something that you have, I think you're bringing at least to Western culture from India, right? This is 5,000 years of of remarkable science and wellness knowledge brought to this space. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, Ayurveda is a system. It's the oldest health system in the world. And I explain it as kind of yoga, but for what we eat and what we put on our body, you know, what we put on our face. And it's really important to understand that, for example, Ayurvedic practitioners for thousands of years have known if you pair pepper and turmeric together, it makes the turmeric more effective. Now, you know, today there's thousands of clinical studies and scientific papers on this impact of this combination. But I'm like, how did they know? They didn't have 5,000 years ago, they didn't have microscopes. They didn't have lab tests. Like, how did they know? So like, at some point you're just like, it's just magic. It's just magic.
Well, you know, I think people often dismissed it. Like, I think new science came in, or Western science came in and dismissed so much of indigenous cultures' practices that kept them well.
Yeah. Yeah. You forget the old, you go to the new, but the new is not really.
It's not always the good.
Yeah.
It isn't always the good. You know, I did a little bit of a genealogy project for my family. So, and one of the things was reading this phenomenal book called Before Columbus. And Before Columbus wasn't just about the diaspora of people, but it was the diaspora of plants and soil and indigenous peoples and what they ate prior to Columbus and how plant-based proteins were so core to our diet, so that when we introduced things like pork, things like they actually made us pretty ill because it was like we had brought in new things into our diets to indigenous cultures. I'm half indigenous Mexican and half, you know, and half Spanish Mexican. And you look at that and you go, oh, this starts to explain so much about the way that we react to food. I was having, you know, you start thinking a little bit about it. It's like, there's something in your DNA at the DNA level that's really fighting it.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Well, I'm a big, big believer in the mitochondrial DNA and the 23 generations of knowledge that are stored within every cell.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is this fine line between medicine and magic and science and magic. And I think some of it is just listening intuitively to what our bodies already know. Yeah. And there's a reason why plants all over this world are grown. There is a reason. And it's because we're supposed to consume them for different reasons, for different things.
Absolutely. They're such a gift to us as human beings that often I think that sometimes we are so disconnected from nature and don't see that nature as there was a point in time in our evolution on this planet as a species, that that was all that was truly available to us. It didn't occur to us to eat anything else but those things.
Yeah,
It's interesting to me. So for our audience, I think there's a couple of really interesting things. For me, I have there. We no longer have salt in our home. We have new salt. And we no longer have old pepper. We have new pepper. And one of my favorite things that I carry in my purse everywhere is the new sea, is the Spicewell sea salt, the pocket sea salt. Tell me a little bit about, tell us a little bit about where, you know, particularly new salt, the root that, you know, is really known for its properties of helping our bodies to adapt to stress. I mean, there's so much goodness packed into these products.
Okay, so the design of the products, we're talking about design, right? As to be 10% of your daily vitamins in a half teaspoon of salt and pepper, which you would use, you know, no one puts half a teaspoon on their food, I hope, but you do quarter teaspoon generally per serving. And so throughout the day, you will use that half teaspoon and you will get 10% of your daily vitamins in a format that is highly absorbable and better for you, but isn't going to interfere if you're already taking other supplements. It's just something that is designed to fill in some gaps in our nutrition. And the pepper is blended with, well, both the salt and pepper are blended with organic kale, organic broccoli, mushrooms, sunflower seeds, kelp, which is actually how we iodize our salt. And they also, the pepper has the turmeric blend, which is in the exact right proportions Ayurvedically to really last, to make that anti-inflammatory function last. And then the great part is if you use this every day, like you do, over time, it's going to build up in your system. And over time, it's going to be more impactful. And so that's really the design of Spicewell. That's our solution.
You know, listening to Raina's itch to change the world does really strike a chord because you see it in the mentality of just her, quote, go saving the world. And you see it in the documentary she works on.
Absolutely. When she said that she was utilizing documentaries as a method of persuasion to change, it dawned on me that persuasion with good intention is more than just a tool for change. It's a part of a framework for transitions.
Exactly. I mean, she took her skill set from the private sector and used it to help others, whether it was for Light Up Malawi, for One World. The ability for her to solve problems and to get on the ground instead of doing it from afar is truly astonishing.
I think you put on something in you're talking about that's really super important, which is, you know, that work in Light Up Malawi just proves that you cannot solve a problem from afar. You've got to get into community and get your hands dirty with the problem. That's the difference between virtue signaling and being virtuous.
I know. And I mean, she did so much, you know, with her background in just digital transformation. Her work with the State Department really did revolutionize a lot of things as well. And, you know, it really did transition to the public sector when she worked with the State Department and transformed the digital landscape there as well.
Right. The reinvention of radio. I mean, really, how visionary at a time when this medium, audio podcasting, was just on the rise. And to be able to bring that to the United States government. And I think we forget that the government, when they create these things, they're public services.
Mm-hmm.
And so here she is now taking all of the digital and AI background that she's had and really starting to apply it to the masses. And I don't know, it's really an inspiration.
Exactly. Her quote, "The first lesson of transformation is nobody wants it," is so fundamentally true because it's that acknowledgement that you have something you need to improve. And it's the understanding that there's always going to be resistance, but if you persevere, even if it's small steps, then you will get to that big transformation. It's not always about leaps, it's about steps.
I love that you've touched on that because throughout my career and having been in the business of transforming corporations with technology, She's absolutely right. The reality is everybody talks about change, but nobody ever really wants to get to the business of changing, which is really hard. Mm-hmm. Think about it on an individual level. When you want to change something, you know, you have to be of a mindset that says, I'm going to be uncomfortable and go through a tremendous amount of growth during that period of time. And so if you don't commit to the change and you don't actually repeat that as a practice, then it's just talk. But that is not in Raina's DNA. She's more than just talk.
I know. I mean, she's helping different companies and different organizations navigate a digital landscape that, to be honest, wasn't there when a lot of people started. So it's having to find that balance of this is where you need to be. This is where you're at. Let's start these baby steps so then you can do the run.
Right. It's the iteration.
Yeah.
Right. It's the love for the iteration. And speaking of transformations, Spicewell, Raina's genius of reinventing salt to have 30% lower sodium has actually helped my body adapt to startup stress. And the pepper with turmeric and kale has played an enormous role in things like aiding my digestion. But more importantly, what I love about it, it is built on the latest science of functional medicine, which is teaching us that turmeric reduces inflammation in the body and leads to long-term brain vitality. And as all of you know, brain vitality is my life's work. Cognitive experience design is about having our brains function holistically in the right and in longer ways.
And listen, I love all of the mixed blended seasoning, the tandoori, the bouillon. I do have to say that this Latina loves the taco seasoning. And listen, as a millennial, we don't get to own homes. We won't be able to retire. Our only line of equity in this life is going to be our longevity. And our only form of wealth is going to be our health. You know, we live in a country where healthcare is not an inalienable right, and it's not always accessible for everyone. So what we ingest and what we put in our bodies needs to add something to that. And as someone who does have a chronic medical illness, I suffer from endometriosis, it's very, very important to me that I am doing what I can to ensure I am giving myself the best life possible. And that includes the little things of what I season my food with.
Well, look, I've always believed that it's the smallest deeds that are better than the greatest intentions, Rachel. And Raina's small deed of putting vitamins sourced from veggies into salt and pepper as a solution to close the American nutrition gap is exactly the right instrument we need to fuel the future of wellness.
With that said, read us out.
This episode was written and produced by the AI Design Corps at Aurora 21 in the heart of New York's magical Hudson Valley. Special thanks to the musical talents of Rachel Bickley, our podcast sound designer. Our theme music was composed by Substance Studios. If you're already following the show, you're well on your way to designing a better future. If not, what are you waiting for? It's time to join the magic. Go to your favorite podcast service and search Designed By with Joanna Pena Bickley and hit follow.
Design the future.